Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 226 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. Today, my guest is Ryan McKeon. Ryan is a personal injury attorney out of Connecticut who has built his practice from a solo practice working, essentially off of a laptop to a thriving a business in Connecticut addressing all aspects of personal injury. And we're going to talk about how he came to be an attorney and how he grew his practice, how he staffed his office, what technology he uses, and all of the things that we all like to learn about regarding others and their success. So without any further delay, here's our friend Ryan McKeon. Ryan McKeon, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
Well, I'm delighted, Ryan, to have you join us today. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Well, I am a personal injury attorney in Glastonbury, and I'm CEO of Connecticut Trial Firm, a firm that I founded to do exactly that, to handle personal injury cases in Connecticut. I come to that having been an associate for 7 years, then going out on my own, having some partners, being a solo, and then finally settling into where it is that I am now.
Terrific. So let's kind of roll back the clock a little bit. Did you always know you wanted to be an attorney, or how did you come about to go to law school?
Yeah, I did. I can look back at my sixth grade yearbook, and it's asked me what do you want to be, and it says, an attorney or an astronaut. And calculus became too hard for me, so astronaut was out of the question. And I worked towards becoming an attorney. I always have enjoyed both the intellectual rigor of it and the challenge of it, and I've also really enjoyed working with people. And I think from a very young age, even as a paperboy, it's I loved my route. I love talking to people, and it was sort of a natural fit for me.
I was thinking about that the other day as a complete aside, and it's just you and me talking here, so nobody cares. The whole idea of a paperboy has completely gone away, hasn't it?
It really has, and it's a loss. When you're 11 years old and you've got 42 papers to deliver, rain, sleet, snow, heat. Your friends are going off, your friends are, coming home from school and doing whatever they do, play video games, hang out, and, you've got to go work for an hour and a half. It teaches a lot of things.
I remember I had a little paper route with just about 40, 45, people on the route, and delivered it on my bicycle, and, just kind of quintessential, 1960s, America. And you knocked on the door at the end of the month to collect the fee. And it was, it was one of those things that people learned about entrepreneurship and business and customer relations and all those kinds of things that we really would like to learn prior to opening a law practice. But there's really not that many opportunities such as, a paper route. Hell, nobody reads a paper anymore except for you and me. So... That creates a problem in and of itself. So we're an attorney, an associate, and one of the things they asked us first day of law school was, what type of law do you want to practice? And I'm like, well, I just got here about an hour ago. How do I know? I said, well, you may not have to know the answer to that today, but by the end of the semester, you better know. And so when did you determine that you wanted to address personal injury?
Well, I always knew going into law school that I really wanted to work on civil litigation and trial stuff. And I also knew that I wanted to represent individuals.
Yeah.
And so out of law school, I found myself sort of in a perfect setting for this, to explore all these things. I was in a very general practice, 5-lawyer firm. And so that meant I could be doing a divorce in the morning and a car accident deposition in the afternoon and a probate litigation the following day and a divorce or a contested divorce the next day. So I was constantly in court on my feet doing civil litigation. And over time, I just found myself more drawn to personal injury cases. I felt that in personal injury, there's the ability to be really creative with some of the work and really help people. I didn't like divorce. I mean, I didn't like doing evictions. Commercial litigation, just it was something I did to pay bills. Like, it was never something that I was really passionate about. And so I gravitated to doing personal injury work. And then when I went out on my own, I was still doing a little bit of everything. But over time, I realized that where I was just naturally dedicating my time and energy was to my personal injury cases. And then I made a very difficult decision for my firm and just said, I'm stopping doing all these other things that are making me money. And I'm going to be taking a pay cut, but I'm going to focus exclusively on injury cases. And I did. I mean, and that was a painful year, but it was so necessary to my future growth.
You know, I started my legal career as a personal injury attorney myself. And, you know, it's a practice area that gets a black eye from the public in a lot of ways. It's, constantly referred to as ambulance chasers and the like. And look, there are some characters in the personal injury field that lend credence to that belief by the public. But at the end of the day, if you're hurt through somebody else's negligence and you're not getting a redress from the insurance companies or the responsible driver, now you become really enamored with your personal injury attorney. You're really glad that that's what they practice. And when you find a good one, they're worth their weight in gold. Literally.
I think that's all very true, Neil. And I think, as personal injury lawyers, if we're being honest, the best thing we can do in a lot of cases is help simply mitigate the harm to our clients in some which way.
Right.
Because if you're permanently hurt or paralyzed, or you've lost a loved one, or all of these things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, or you've got some scarring or any host of things, no amount of money is going, you would never trade any amount of money for that thing. And so, a lot of times it's, I think folks think, if you watch enough TV commercials, that, personal injury, people who are injured are out there to get rich. And most of the time that is not the outcome. Most of the time, the outcome is simply, we've been able to mitigate some of the financial harm that our clients have suffered.
And I like the choice of the word mitigation there, because it never replaces or makes up for, or it's never more than is needed. It always is, in my opinion, is less than what is really deserved. And it only does, as you said, it only goes to the extent of helping to mitigate the harm caused by others.
Yep.
When you decided to focus on personal injury, is there a particular aspect of injury cases that were of interest to you? I mean, did you limit it to trucks or motorcycles, or was it more of a broad personal injury practice?
It's more of a broad personal injury practice, we haven't limited it in that way at this point. What really inspired us, the things that we really wanted to do, was we want to do trial work. We want to try cases. And that's really You know, there are two things I love about, or maybe three, that I really love about what I do. And one is running the business and helping and seeing that grow and coaching my team and implementing the systems and do all the things that you talk about on this wonderful podcast. The second thing I like to do is try cases. Like if you told me like, okay, you could either just be running the business or trying cases, I think I'm happy in either of those two worlds, right? And unfortunately, you know, we don't, even in a good year, we don't, only 2 or 3% of our cases that are in litigation ever get to trial for one reason or another. So that is a, the opportunities there on the plaintiff side are for at bat period are pretty limited. And now you factor in COVID, where, you know, we have no idea when our next jury trial is ever going to be.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. That, you know, we understand this as attorneys, and, you know, I think the public doesn't often do so, but the vast majority of cases, the overwhelming majority of cases never make it to trial. And in fact, sure. I used to share a white paper with our clients explaining why that's the case, because clients come to you expecting to go to court, expecting to have their day in court. And, you know, they're surprised when 97, 98% never make it there. And so I always try to manage those expectations up front. Is that something that you address?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we do a lot of addressing that both in our marketing and on intake and really trying to educate and empower our clients about why cases go to trial and why cases settle and what the risks are of various things. And, you know, the truth is that there's so much information out there that unless the case has some massive disagreement where it, you know, it's either worth, you know, $0 or $1 million, or there are liens on the case, or there's a very big dispute over what happened, you know, or how injured that they are, how injured a person is, you know. And again, those big disputes generally tend to lead to irreconcilable dollar differences, right? Because the parties really, you know, they essentially get into a place where they have no choice. And it's our job to sort of educate clients, you know, why that is, or what the likelihood is here, or why the case is likely to settle, or when it's likely to settle. And it's, I mean, ultimately at the end of the day, it's really just, you know, risk assessment and risk management, and a little bit of empathy for how insurance companies react and respond to these things as well.
And it's a business decision. You have to make that decision whether or not you want to put, you know, a certain amount of dollars at risk in order to go to trial, and what's the likelihood of you prevailing and getting more or getting less. And, you know, it's a trade-off. So it's something you have to address. Well, I figure most folks on the podcast here understand that process. So let's circle back to then when you decided to leave and open up your solo practice. Kind of take us back to that period of time. Were you working from the kitchen table, or did you decide to open a physical office, or how were you physically set up when you first started?
Oh, Neil, I had the, and you're going to like this, I know you love Apple, and as do I, and you're going to like this one a lot. I had what was classically described in the E-Myth book as an entrepreneurial fit. I was actually in Bahamas. I had a few gin and tonics at the beachside bar.
There you go.
I was sitting there just watching the Bahamian moon and the wind over the ocean on this sort of glorious January night. As opposed to being in the cold Northeast. And I was reading the Steve Jobs biography.
Yeah.
And I really thought to myself, I said, you know, look, I have this, there's this opportunity out there to do things differently. I was at a very traditional firm, a firm that was all paper-based, a firm that was not tech-driven, a firm that was not process or systems-driven, a firm that was not design-driven. And I said, you know what, I can take some of these principles that Apple has, and I can bring it into making my own firm. And I actually texted a friend from Bahamas, and I said, hey, want to start a law firm. And the whole notion was actually driven by the Steve Jobs thing, you know, let's be pirates. We actually hung a pirate flag in our office.
Yeah.
And so there was this sort of countercultural element, and act of doing it. And we planned the law firm for months. Then I left and went on my own. And yeah, I didn't have an office initially because we were actually building one. We were actually remodeling an office, and that wouldn't open until several months later. And then ultimately, as is the case in a lot of ways, a lot of times my partnership did not work out as we had hoped. I mean, they're still a successful firm doing family law, and I'm successful doing personal injury law, but we didn't work out together for various reasons.
Right.
And
so then you found yourself on your own in a new space. And so how are you going about getting your personal injury clients at that time?
A lot of it was word of mouth, and it was from existing clients that I had. And some of it, some of my bigger cases actually just came from my Facebook personal page. People I went to high school with knew that I was a lawyer. And sometimes, I would get calls that were on some very significant cases simply by people who knew who I was and knowing what I do, contacting me to handle those cases. And as I was able to handle some bigger wrongful death cases, that helped me build a name for myself in doing this kind of work, which made it easier then to get more work.
Sure. Now, there's a couple of things there that I want to kind of unpack a little bit. So did you formally circle back to past clients and in an effort to keep top of mind with them, you know, Christmas cards, newsletters, phone calls, or was it just they remembered the great job that you did and when the opportunity presented themselves were happy to refer you?
It was the latter. I had no systems. I had no note cards. I had no birthday cards or e-newsletters, or I had none of those things.
All of which I know is different now, but I just wanted to pull that out a little bit.
Yeah, and honestly, it's like I think it's that, you know, from early on in my career, it's just like it's back being that paper boy. It's
right.
Like I knew if I did a good level of customer service and I went the extra mile and I just talked to people as if they were people going about their day, that it ultimately resulted in more tips, more business, right? I just did that through my law career. Like there was no small matter to me, and I always tried to make my clients feel like they mattered, and because they did matter to me. And that, you know, doing that with a small group of people just built trust over time. And again, it's not systematized, it's not scaled, it's just hand to hand to hand over time.
But then the other thing that you did, and I think attorneys are somewhat reluctant to embrace this, is that while you didn't exactly promote your law firm on your Facebook personal page, you didn't hide the fact that that's what you did either. And I think that's important because, you know, look, that's where our connections are. That's where the people are. You know, they're talking around the water cooler that's literally online. And so there's a way to be, you know, genuine and non-salesy and not cheesy, but just let people know that you know, this is what you do, and this is, you know, how you do it.
And that's a great point, Neil. And it's like it's just being out there, being genuine, letting people know, because, you know, I maybe we've all had this happen, but I've certainly had it happen in my career where somebody says, oh, you know, my aunt was in a severe car accident, or my mom, or my brother. Boy, I wish I had hired you instead of the TV firm, you know,
right.
and you're like, oh,
yeah, like, I wish you had too.
You know, but it's like this moment of marketing failure, right? You have somebody who's warm to you. You have somebody like, and all they had to know was that this is the work you do, and you would have had a, you know, a significant case. And I think that's an undervalued sort of marketing dynamic.
Well, you said something very pertinent there too, and I don't want to lose sight of that, is that when that happens, you have to look at that as a failure of marketing, I think so many times we look at it and say, oh man, the big guy beat me again. Man, if I just had the resources they had, you know, I'd get all these great cases. But it's kind of the wrong end of the telescope to be looking at it, I think. I think you were quite correct when you said, wow, there's something I'm doing wrong where there's a warm lead here, a friend of mine, somebody who I know, somebody who I'm connected to in some fashion or another, yet they didn't think of me when this matter came up.
Yeah, that is a, you know, a very important point. And I think, you know, if listeners only get that from this conversation, that they've got something. Yeah. It's like, how do you bridge that, right?
Well, right. You know, and at least at first, it's a mindset. You know, if initially you're a woe is me, why can't I get that great case? I'll never be able to compete type of person. That mindset's not going to lead to success. But if you're like, all right, you know, I missed this one. What can I do to capture the next one? What did I miss here? And look at it more as a failure on your part, as opposed to and something that you can correct, as opposed to this is what life has dealt me.
Exactly. I always think of it like there's always a sports analogy here where it's like if you're a relief pitcher in baseball and you throw a pitch and Aaron Judge hits it, you know, 500 feet into the upper deck, you can't be upset about it. You've got to watch the video, figure out what happened, and go out there next time having, you know, improved and not dwelling upon that pitch that maybe landed somewhere in Westchester.
469 feet out in left center against those Red Sox of yours. I saw that. I saw that. He really crushed that ball. Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by our good friends at Ruby. And returning to the podcast, our friends at Spotlight Branding. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And for those of you who have listened for some time, you might recognize that returning to the sponsor position here with our podcast is Spotlight Branding. And Spotlight Branding, as you may remember, I was a client of theirs for many months, if not years, before they became a sponsor of the show. So I speak from experience that if you're looking to build content for your practice and have that managed for you in terms of blog posting, social media posting, email dissemination, email newsletter dissemination, that you can do no worse than Spotlight Branding. They're a terrific resource to draw upon, and I wholeheartedly support them, and I'm grateful for their sponsorship of this podcast. So then you got these clients, you started having some success, and you're in your office space, and things are starting to look good. And when did you decide you needed to start adding staff, and how did you go about doing so?
I actually decided to start adding staff at a financial low point for me, because we had switched over to personal injury, and it was a drag. I was turning down those bread and butter divorce cases that would, you know, allow me to bring money home every month. I was turning down all this work, but I was working myself into a frenzy, just an unsustainable amount of work, 7 days a week, and just treading water financially at best. And it really hit me And it was that I wasn't going to ever get out of this situation until I really leveraged the time and talent of others. And when I accepted that, and I accepted that I have to hire and I have to find a way to make it work. And not only do I need to hire one person, I need to hire two people. Because if I hire just this one person, you know, the skills of this job are going to be diminished by the sort of day-to-day answering the phone and doing intakes, as opposed to doing the litigation paralegal work that I need done. And so I made the decision to hire two people, and we had a little bit of cushion, not much, and a real determination that we were going to make it work, and it did. And then, you know, after we hired two people, a month later it was a third, and then it was a fourth, and those things, flipping that switch and taking that risk was really hard.
You know, that's a story. That's a story we hear often here, and you know, there's a tendency again on most of our part to say, "Well, as soon as I get my revenues up to a point where I'm feeling comfortable, that's when I can go about add staff and make my life a little easier." And time and time and time again, I hear from successful attorneys like yourself that actually the time to do that is right in the very beginning. Of course, you need a little bit of cushion, as you said, but there's nothing that motivates you to make it work as knowing that you only have 2 months worth of cushion, and you better make it work. And this way you leverage everybody's talent so that you spend more time acquiring new clients while you don't have to do all that pre-litigation, you know, discovery work or answer the phones.
It's really a mindset shift, because I think before I did that, I always thought of employees as an expense. Right. As in, I make X amount a year, and then if I hire an employee for $50,000, I'm now X minus 50. I have lost 50,000. When really, if you do it right and you have enough work and you have some business sense and some systems and some process in place, that those employees are going to be they're going to add to the asset side of the equation. And they're going to be the reason why you break through prior income barriers. You know, and that always has to be balanced against cash flow and all of these things. But I think it's mostly a mindset thing. If you're reasonably able to keep a stream of cases coming in, and then you say, okay, I can do this. Somebody else can do this job. You're going to make money if you're able to flip that switch.
How'd you go about finding folks?
We found our intake specialist on Indeed. Okay. And we had a paralegal that we hired that came referred to us from another law firm. So those are how we made our first two hires.
And where do you stand staffing wise now?
There's 10 of us total, and we are looking. We will be growing. We will be adding some more people probably this year, I think. And we're meeting tomorrow to discuss that. So. It's grown as we've grown.
Great. How has this pandemic impacted you? I mean, we know that trial work has come to a screeching halt, and who knows when, as you said, when trials are going to start and kick back up in full. Have you been able to continue to take on clients and at least work them through the pre-litigation phase of the case?
Yeah, business has basically been normal. We took an initial hit on leads being down about 60% pretty much in the month of April. They started picking up in May, back resuming normal levels by June, July. So that on that side of the coin, there was a temporary dip in leads, which was okay. I mean, we were a little bit understaffed to begin with. And so really that time of not having trials and jury selection, these things that take up immense amount of time, allowed us to really catch up on some of the files that we did have. The lack of trials is an issue. But again, defense lawyers have to eat too. So there's depositions and mediations and things that are going on, and our cases are resolving. I mean, we are able to resolve cases, and we've had some insurance adjusters tell us, well, if you don't like my offer, good luck, because you might not get a jury until 2030 on this kind of thing. But that's been the exception. I mean, we've been moving our cases. We've been signing cases. The real biggest challenge for us has been we have a bunch of team members who have young children, and there's an absence of childcare, and keeping our people safe and sane and trying to move things forward. Well, being home with a 4 and an 8-year-old is been a real trying thing that we've been dealing with.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. And, you know, I've been following along with some of the litigators who are bemoaning the fact that, you know, a lot of their depositions have to be done now, you know, via video conferencing, and it's just not the same. And I can appreciate that, but I suspect that we're going to see, you know, video depositions and video pretrial hearings and you know, a whole lot more of video communications before we set foot back into a courtroom.
I agree, and I hope it. I hope that that continues, and I really think it will. Because, look, I joke with my other, some of the other lawyers I talk to. I'm like, you know, humans aren't dogs. Like, we don't need to sniff each other and smell each other and size each other up. The point of a deposition, really, Neil, is to create a transcript. And you can do that by phone, video, a whole host of other things. And again, it, you know, there are some moments in depositions that, wow, it really moves the needle and it really changes everything. I think most depositions are pretty mundane. The witness says basically what you know or what you think that they're going to say. Yeah. So it doesn't, you have to do it. You have to check that box. You have to get them to commit to their positions. But in reality, it doesn't move the needle a whole lot most of the time. I've taken depositions that have taken, you know, what the insurance company said were no-pay cases into significant settlements. But, you know, I think that the savings to society and lawyers and everything is just so immense. You know, like I had a deposition of an expert. It was in Manhattan. I would have had to have left my house at 4 a.m. to get to Manhattan for 10 a.m. You know, I would have gotten back probably when my kids were in bed, and there's no difference. The transcript is fine. The Zoom recording is fine. And it saved, I don't know, 8 lawyers from having to go down to Manhattan.
I've talked to folks and I've suggested that it might even be a better process, because if you're on a Zoom call, you can record the deposition yourself. So you have a copy, where you didn't always have that if you were using a deposition company to videotape or to record the deposition. So, I mean, obviously you need those to maintain an official record as well, but to have your own video and audio copy of the deposition, I think, is invaluable.
It is invaluable, and it's such a cost saving for the client, because most of the time, again, as we talked about, my cases aren't going to go to trial, but it could be useful to have just a general transcript, so I can take the audio file, upload it to Rev, get 95 or 98% accuracy on the thing. And then if I realize, like, oh, this is heading for summary judgment or trial, I can order the transcript at the cost of, you know, $1,000 to the client if necessary. So having that versatility, I think it just makes so much sense.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we've kind of touched on these subjects already, starting with, you know, the inspiration that Steve Jobs provided to you on the beaches in the Bahamas. So tell us a little bit about your technology setup and how you are able to deliver services through the use of technology.
Well, I mean, we are a Mac-based firm, except for my partner, who is a Windows-based holdout. But I don't think that technological difference matters all that much, or matters even as much as it did
not anymore.
8 years ago when I started. Really, our firm is really powered by FileVine, which is our case management software, which is just tremendously powerful project management software, communications, and that is a great efficiency for us. We use lead software called Lead Docket, and that's our CRM, which is also useful. And otherwise, it's a pretty traditional suite of Adobe and Microsoft Office and Slack, and that's pretty much all we need.
Do you use any trial presentation tools?
Yes, we use TrialPad.
How was your experience learning TrialPad and using it?
Oh, it's such wonderful software. And it's like, what a time to be alive, where I can on my iPad, on the fly, pull things, highlight things. It used to be these wonky Elmo machines.
Right.
And having that all at my fingertips, and it's so intuitive and so easy to get the right visual in front of the jury at the right time that it's such a gift, especially like when you're cross-examining a witness and they're telling some story that's completely, it's not what they had said in deposition. You're not fumbling through a file, you're putting that up on the screen, and then you're asking, the witness, you were deposed, didn't you say this? And the jury sees it, and sometimes we've never had it happen, but we've queued up video portions of a deposition, and we would love to at some point when somebody changes their testimony, play video back to them of them saying something completely different under oath. We've never had that opportunity, but
I was lucky enough to meet the founders of Lit Software, who are the publishers of TrialPad, back in the day at Victor Medina's conference down in Disney World. Victor, who's been on the program, I think he's now been on the program 4 times or 5 times. He's kind of the leader in the clubhouse, is Victor. But I remember when they first brought TrialPad out, and there wasn't, it was, I think, first generation of the iPad, and they were using it on laptops as well. And you could tell where the future of this software was going, that it was bringing high-end trial presentation capability to anyone who had, a regular laptop or iPad. Now it's just kind of brilliant software that I think, if I were a litigator and I went into court and my opponent had TrialPad and I still had an easel that I was drawing on, I'd be worried for my client because it makes such a difference.
Well, and again, juries more than anything hate their time being wasted, and right. As they should. You only get so much life, Neil. Right. And if you are presenting your case in a way that shows that you've thought about their needs and satisfied that basic need, I can't help but think it shows up in the results.
Yeah, when I first started doing litigation in that regard, and you would have to show a picture of, say, the intersection where the accident occurred, you'd have to hand the witness a marker and have them draw an arrow and label it and show that to the jury. It was so cumbersome and so tiring, and it wasn't persuasive at all. But now when you can get them to actually place an image of a car and make it move and show the impact, among other things, and review medical records and x-rays and circle that broken bone, it's a tremendous piece of software. I'm pleased to understand that you use it and find it so useful.
It's fantastic. Any trial lawyer, it's just worth the price of an iPad, without yeah. question.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Ryan, this has been great. I wanted to just touch base for a moment and note that you, and along the way, kind of put all this down, all this information and these lessons and experience that you've had, and you put it in the form of a book. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Yeah, I co-authored Tiger Tactics with my friends Shay Ruane, Billy Tarasio, Bill Umansky, and Teresa Rose DeGray. And really, what had happened is at a really formative point in my practice, I was in a a Slack group, and I was with Billy and Jay, who just are some of my closest friends in this. And what was happening is we had this like years long dialogue. And one morning I said, you know what, we should turn some of this into a book. And Billy and Jay said yes. And then we went out and we decided that what we wanted to do was, you know, not just share tactics, but really share stories. And our mission was to write about things that hurt, because we hoped that that could help others. And so we all did. We wrote the book, and we took 10 different areas that we thought were important, and we all shared our 2 cents on it. So the reader's getting different perspectives on these things. And we wrote it, and it took us about 18 months to get it finally turned into an actual book. Because if you ever set out to write a book, Neil, the writing is puts you at about the 20-yard line. Right. And then you've got 80 yards of editing and re-editing and copy editing and formatting and all of these various right. things. But we got it into the wild, and it's nothing that we make any sort of money on. It was just it was something that we felt like we should do.
But it's been positively reviewed and received. I mean, I read the reviews on Goodreads and Amazon, and read some of the excerpts. And your co-authors are not all attorneys, correct?
They all are.
Oh, they all are. Okay.
They all have. Yep. And so what we tried to do is we tried to get different perspectives from different practice areas, okay. from different lawyers who do things differently. But no, they're all practitioners, and some have very large firms, and other, I think Teresa is a true solo.
Okay. Well, tell our audience how they may go about getting the book and how they can connect with you if they want to follow up on anything you've had to share today.
You can get our book on Amazon, and you can connect with me. The best places to connect with me are LinkedIn or Twitter at Ryan McKean.
Terrific. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. I wish you the best of luck. And next time I'm up there in the Northeast, I'd love to come say hi and introduce ourselves in person, if we're allowed to do that anytime soon.
Likewise, Neil. Next time I'm down in Maryland, I usually make about an annual trip down there. I will certainly like to connect.
Terrific. Well, Ryan, thanks ever so much for being a guest today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Neil.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility, and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.